Good afternoon. This is West Sunset 2050 Trust, First Nation Star Mortgage, LLC 70754. If counsel for appellants ready to proceed, you may do so. If you wish to reserve any time, so say.
Good afternoon, if it may please the court. My name is Louis Sayon. I'm the attorney for West Sunset Trust. We are here today because we are seeking a reversal and remand with instructions on the lower court's order that held that the deed of trust survived the HOA foreclosure sale. My client is the purchaser at this HOA sale. And we're asking for the court for reversal generally on three different reasons. The first reason is that the sale was not happening. And what's clear from the record, and it's not very clear from at least the briefing in this below, is that the NationStar and Bank of America both had record notice or received notice of the NOS in this case. The only defect that's being complained about is they did not get notice of the notice of default at the time. And because the facts are a little bit confusing, kind of a board kind of held ulcer. There was a deed in lieu that was first recorded on this property, which at the time of the HOA foreclosure sale, they were the record holder of the property. So the NOD was sent to New Freedom Mortgage. There's no question about that. New Freedom Mortgage got the actual notice of the NOD. Right after that, there was an assignment right in here that MERS took over. And then there's the assignment.
When was the assignment relative to the recordation of the deed in lieu?
I'm sorry. No.
When was the assignment?
The assignment was over here back on March 20th, 2013. If you'd like, I have copies of this. It would be easier.
I think we need it, especially for some older justices.
Okay.
Don't let the glasses fool you.
Should I approach?
Yes, please.
And if you could share that with the opposing counsel.
Here. Why don't you give me the pile? I'll pass it down.
Why don't we hold the clock while you're doing that?
Yeah,
so it's being passed around, just to kind of give you a little bit of preview, that what this illustrates is that the assignment was recorded between the NOD and the NOS. So the assignment itself was, at the time of the NOD being recorded and mailed, it was recorded sent to the proper party, at least the party that had record, or was record, the record holder of property. Afterwards, they got the assignment, and then Bank of America and NationStar servicer then received notice of all of it. Now, the briefing, again, is a bit unclear from the other side. Page 7 say that there was no notices that were ever given to any party. And again, the order also is a little bit misleading, too, where it says Red Rock Financial Services provided no foreclosure notices to any of the parties. Now, again, that's technically true, but again, the record reflects that there was a change from Red Rock to ULS in between there. So Red Rock may have not provided all the notices, but they did provide notice to at least New Freedom Mortgage, the record holder, and then once ULS took over the property, they provided record notice to everybody. That isn't in dispute. So the sale, we believe, is completely valid. There is no question that they ultimately received notice. Now, we're aware that this court has at least indicated that there is, that 116 is a substantial compliance statute, and in that case, that was recently turned over. The question was whether the beneficiary actually got notice and whether there was any prejudice to the beneficiary as well. Now, we're arguing that there's no prejudice in this case for two reasons. It's because back when the deed in lieu was recorded back in 2011, there was two separate recordings by the bank. And back on July 2011, and then one February 2012. Now, both in those instances, they would have been on notice, the bank would have been on notice, that there was this deed in lieu that was recorded that they're challenging the validity. So They did nothing to correct
it. Is there anything that says that New Freedom did not accept the deed in lieu that was recorded?
There's nothing. And then that was part of the record, that there was no affidavit from either New Freedom, from NationStar, or Bank of America that said, no, we don't, you know, we never accepted this, we never looked to correct it, no declaration whatsoever. But there, all this time had passed from the time that this deed in lieu occurred to the time that the foreclosure sale took place. Now, the record also does reflect that there were emails between Bank of America and the borrower that showed that there was a negotiation process for this deed in lieu. Now, that occurred in 2012. And oddly enough, at the time of that, those negotiations, those emails that's in the record, the deed in lieu had already been recorded on property. So there would be constructive notice that the deed in lieu was already recorded. So regardless of whether it was a fraudulent deed, there was just nothing done to prevent it. There was nothing done to correct
the record. The deed in lieu says that both versions of it, and there are two that I found, they say that it was sent to New Freedom.
That's correct. They were just saying that, we're not saying that they knew about it, they had constructive notice when both there was two recordings of assignments, one to MERS, to Bank of America from MERS, and then one from Cooper Castle as the trustee of the deed of trust. So what we're arguing here is that based on that, there was no prejudice because they would have had record notice that this deed had occurred. The tax documents, there would have at least been some notice that there was something wrong with the title of this property.
Well, if the deed in lieu is successful, then there's nothing to transfer.
That's correct.
So what's your position?
Well,
is there nothing to transfer, or is there a deed?
Well, for the sake of this argument, Your Honor, we're arguing that, one, the sale was invalid, and two, even if you say the sale was invalid, that the deed in lieu still holds water because there's no evidence of these back and forth saying why the deed in lieu was actually recorded. But NRS 1111.105 doesn't require that the deed in lieu be signed by the grantee. So, for all sorts of purposes, the deed in lieu was properly recorded, and at least time went on where there was nothing there to challenge it or nothing there to ultimately reverse the record there. And the point is about the sale is that regardless of whether you accept the deed in lieu, it's either the sale, based on the record of the sale, the lender got notice, the beneficiaries got notice, either the deed was extinguished or there was a record holder who got extinguished by the sale. So one way or the other, even if you accept the deed in lieu, and that's why I started with the sale of this, either you accept either result, whether the deed in lieu was proper or not, the sale, in our position, the sale is still valid. So that's what we're arguing today, and that's why reversal is appropriate in this circumstance. Finally, the last reason, Your Honor, is this: the argument was made right before Shadowwood, and then Shadowwood came out afterwards. So the one thing that if you reject all the other arguments, the court never considered the bona fide purchaser status of my client. There was never an analysis, there was never a balance of equities. And in this case, what we're arguing is that because of the circumstances of the deed in lieu, that the equities in this case would have been in favor of our client because there was simply nothing to correct the record. You know, from 2011 all the way to 2013, when they had an opportunity to do something about this, what they call a rogue deed in lieu. And if you have any questions.
Just does NRS 111.205 require that New Freedom, would have required New Freedom to sign off to accept that to be consistent with the statute of frauds?
Your Honor, that is 111.105.
I'm asking you about 205.
205.
I appreciate 105, but 111.205, wouldn't that apply? Wouldn't New Freedom have had to sign off on the deed?
And that's where we started with the sale. I think we had the argument that they didn't have to, and I feel like the more important point is that the sale was valid. So regardless of how we frame it, I agree with your position that does play, but we're saying that 105 controls the circumstance. But even if you do resort to looking at 205, our primary position is that the sale is always valid. So regardless of...
It doesn't matter to you.
Exactly, yes.
Counsel, my only concern about 105 applying that, now 205 is if we did an opinion and said that a deed in lieu could be signed by the grantor, not the grantee, you know, you create havoc in the real estate market, because anybody that's underwater wants to avoid a deficiency judgment would just issue a deed in lieu and it would wipe out the deficiency. So I'm concerned about the policy part of that, of what can happen.
I completely understand. That's why we started with the sale being valid.
That's fine. It may not matter in this case. Who knows? We'll see what the other side says.
I completely understand. We kind of recognize that a little bit, because, I mean, you don't want people just signing off deeds and then right. sending them in. But I think in this case, it just bears to at least some consideration that, you know, this deed in lieu was done back in 2011. You know, we know from the record that there are ongoing negotiations by somebody at Bank of America who's considered a deed in lieu specialist in 2012. New Freedom would have gotten all the tax assessment, all the tax documents for a couple years after that. And then you have these two other recordings beyond that. So, you know, I understand that position, but at some point, I think there's got to be some responsibility by the bank to at least correct the record, because then you have this circumstance where now, you know, you go to public auction, the Red Rock, the only thing they can do is they pull, you know, there's testimony, but they pull up the land record, the trustee's deed, or I'm sorry, the title report, and this is what they see. This is 2 years after the deed in lieu has already been recorded, twice already where you've had two assignments, and then even some ongoing negotiations. So I understand your concern, but for illustrative purposes, I think that kind of curtails into some other analysis that we have, that one, the sale is valid, and two, you know, if you're going to look at the balance in the equities, I think the equities balance on our side.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon. Ariel Stern on behalf of Bank of America and NationStar Mortgage. This court should affirm the district court. The district court correctly recognized that the sale was not valid due to lack of notice. I think there is agreement. In fact, there's no dispute either in the district court or really from what we heard today from the appellant that Red Rock Financial did not provide the notice of default to the beneficiary of the deed of trust. That's undisputed. The secondary issue that comes from that is, to whom did they provide the notice? According to what came in the record, the notice was given to New Freedom Mortgage. And that makes the deed in lieu of foreclosure obviously quite relevant. I think the district court correctly recognized that the deed in lieu was a fraudulent document, that it had no effect, and that it did not discharge the deed of trust. That conclusion was supported amply in the record. There were, for example, two assignments of the mortgage that took place after. And I think it may make sense to...
Beyond the assignments, what establishes the deed in lieu is kind of mysterious in this case.
It is.
And it's not particularly well briefed, candidly, on whether or not it's effective on its face.
I don't disagree with that, Justice Picker, and I'd like to address the facial sufficiency of the deed in lieu.
Thank you. Please do.
There are a number of problems with it, and the most important one has to do with some of the questions that were already asked. It's not signed by the party against whom it's sought to be charged. And the specific nature of a deed in lieu becomes quite relevant in that context. A deed in lieu is typically the result of a negotiation in which the lender decides to give up its deed of trust. So it's a two-way street. It's not a conveyance where just one piece of property is given. Two property interests are exchanged. And so the deed of trust is being reconveyed in the deed in lieu if it's done properly. And I think there's a case that's quite on point.
What's the case that you would cite for them?
The case, Your Honor, is, and this does not address specifically the deed in lieu, but the case, and I admit this is not in our brief and should have been, is Summa Corp versus Greenspun, 96 Nevada, 247, published in 1980. And I'd like to read from that case, from that decision on page 252. This court wrote, we believe that NRS 111.205 subsection 1 has direct application to the surrender of a deed of trust. And I think that's relevant because a deed of trust is not a lien, it's a property interest. Nevada is a property, it's not a lien theory, it's a title theory state. And the deed of trust has language that actually conveys title and trust for the duration of the obligation. And based on that, Your Honor, there is
we think a necessity under both 105 and 205, 111-105 and 111-205, for there to be a right. 111-105 speaks specifically to conveyances in a deed. And if this instrument, the disputed instrument, was to effectuate a reconveyance of the deed of trust, it has to be signed by the beneficiary. That's, I think, plain under 111.105. And
I kind of looked at this, trying to get my understanding coming into argument. It looks like in California, there's a presumption that if a deed in lieu is recorded and signed off on by the grantor, that it's accepted by the beneficiary, and it gets into issues with the merger and intervening liens and so on, and that to refute that presumption, you need to file a notice of non-acceptance by the deed of trust holder or the grantee of the deed in lieu. I am not versed in how that would work here. Summa didn't involve a deed in lieu, going by my memory on that case.
It did not.
So I'm not sure where Nevada law is at that. I'm not sure it matters in this case, but this record is very confusing.
Justice Pickering, while it is confusing in some senses, I think it's clear on enough points for the court to affirm the district court.
Is there a recorded assignment of the deed of trust, or is it an assignment of the interest in the note? That's the other thing. I could not find the recorded assignment of the deed of trust, even crediting your position that the deed in lieu didn't extinguish or put all the property interest in New Freedom.
So, Justice Perkin, if you return to page 598 of the record.
Okay.
And I will go to a review.
Well, I can't go there with you because I don't have the whole record, but I can write down the site.
Okay, so the site is page 598.
Okay. 598,
and this is the first assignment of the deed of trust. This is dated, recorded in July, to be precise, July 29th of 2011.
And that's recording the deed of trust, not just the note.
Correct, Your Honor. So, and the title of the document is Assignment of Deed of Trust, and the verbiage is for value received, the undersigned holder of the deed of trust, the assignee lists the address, and then it states that the deed of trust, specifically, all beneficial interests under that certain deed of trust, describe the work together with the note and obligations there, and describe and the money due and to become owned. So it effectuates both. And we believe that this point actually favors affirming the district court because this document was recorded 4 months after the original recordation of the deed in lieu and 1 month after the do-over. And so right almost contemporaneously, there is record, and the appellant here, Sunset West, would be charged with that under its duty to investigate. There is already evidence in this record that the beneficiary of the deed of trust is proceeding as if there were no deed in lieu. This assignment would make no sense if there was a deed in lieu. If there was a deed in lieu, the deed of trust would have been reconveyed, and the obligation would have been charged off in the books as paid for whatever amount would have been agreed to. And so the fact that there's an assignment of the deed of trust, but this verbiage is completely contradictory to the idea that there was a deed in lieu. I understand the point that this is record notice, and Sunset West makes an issue of that. It's respectfully record notice to them, because when Red Rock commences the foreclosure approximately a year later in April of 2012, this is all part of the record. And I will note that United First Legal, basically the subsequent trustee, actually gave notice of sale. That point, I think, was a little confused in the briefing as well. And there is evidence of that, at least in the testimony of the Rule 36 witness for the trustee. So if in 2013, the subsequent trustee was able to effectuate notice to Bank of America and NationStar, why couldn't Red Rock? Red Rock had the ability. It could have done the title report. It didn't do so. And so I think it's asking the doctrine of substantial compliance to do entirely too much to substitute it, basically excuse the delivery of the notice of default.
Mr. Stern, can I get on another issue?
Yes.
I frankly think the deed of lieu was red herring, I don't know if it's a pun or not, but if we can get to the notice issue here with your client. Now, when the association started its proceedings, NationStar wasn't the beneficiary of the deed of trust. Correct. It was Red Rock, something like that. After NationStar became beneficiary, it did receive notice of the sale of the real property. I think what the opposing counsel is arguing, that if there's a substantial compliance standard, that might be good enough, you know, to give you proper notice there. And if you didn't act on it as a result of the notice of sale, you waive your rights and you're out. So what's your response to that?
Two responses. One, very technical, and I'd like to get that out of the way first. Since we're on summary judgment here, for purposes of this argument, I will assume that the notice were properly given. I don't think the district court actually made that finding. So if there's a remand, it should be not with instruction to enter judgment in favor of the respondent. That technicality out of the way, the overall response, Justice Gibbons, is that you have to have substantial compliance. We agree with that. This court's already said that. Not sending one of the notices at all and relying on a subsequent notice is not substantial compliance. That's just not good enough. You're asking the notice of sale to accomplish too much. And I think this case, the record didn't develop to this point, but I'd like to illustrate why that's a meaningful concept. I think it's undisputed here. Bank of America was the beneficiary of the deed of trust at the time that Red Rock sent the notice of default to the wrong party, Freedom Mortgage. Bank of America was paying super priority loans. That was their protocol. That was their practice and procedure. And so if Bank of America had received this, barring some aberration from the standard protocol, that would have been a payment. And in this case, would be a tender case. But having not received the notice of default, we don't have a tender for that reason. And so that's an illustration of how this could have gone differently. The statute requires a 90-day cooling off period after the 90 days. In fact, one of the recitals in the trustee's deeds that are often invoked by the investors in these cases is that there was the elapsing of 90 days. All right, so if the beneficiary didn't receive the 90 days, couldn't have, if it didn't receive the notice of default, you're basically saying you got the notice of sale, and the notice of sale cures everything, including dispensing with the 90-day cooling off requirement. That's just too much.
But Mr. Stern, you when NationStar took the property, you were on record notice of the deficiency of assessments and the default. So you could have paid the super priority lien as well, and you got the only notice I believe you were entitled to, which was notice of the foreclosure sale. So your brief throughout talks about what notice Bank of America got. What notice didn't, you know, how does that relate to your issues? It seems like you got the notice to which you were entitled, and you certainly had record notice that this was a problem.
I think we were entitled to both the notice of default and the notice of sale, so I would push back a little bit on the premise of the question.
But you agree they're in the record. There's record notice.
I think there is record notice. I think there is a requirement of more than record notice. I think and this bleeds a little bit into the concept of the weighing of the equities that Sunset West also talked about. It is, I think, insufficient, both under the statute, but certainly under the weighing of equities, to rely on the beneficiary of deed of trust, who presumably has thousands of these documents, to search the records and actually acquire practical notice. I think the obligation is on the foreclosing party to give that notice. And that is certainly what Red Rock typically tried to do. They just made a mistake in this case and didn't give notice to the beneficiary of trust.
And that affects you because you say if they had, then they may have paid it and we wouldn't have to and we wouldn't be here.
Or we might be here, but we'd be talking about different issues. I think what the statute wants is for the banks to pay these liens, or wanted,
right,
because it's all in the past tense. Bank of America was paying these liens.
Yeah, but NationStar could have paid the lien.
NationStar could have, Justice Stiglitz, but when NationStar would have found out about it, it would have been at the notice of sale phase, and the 90-day period would have elapsed. The statutory, and so I think if you're looking at this from a substantial compliance perspective, I think it's undisputed that they did not serve the notice of default. Our position is that they needed to.
On
whoever the beneficiary was, which would have been B of A before the second assignment. And having failed to do so, that's a defect that requires requires the outcome that the district court reached. And I think what the discussion we're having here is whether the notice of sale can cure that. And I think conceptually it's the question is, well, we knew about it anyway. So what's the harm? No harm, no foul. We reject it because the statute requires 90 days. The statute gives us 90 days to figure it out, to investigate, to ask for the money, to pay it, to see if we've got the right amount. There's been many cases on that when we do have 90 days where there's issues as well. And so we just think that the, and you look at the trustee deed recitals and we talk about the election of 90 days, it may have been an election of 90 days for somebody, certainly not for the beneficiary. And so we think that the, just to put it in a succinct sentence, substantial compliance, while it applies, it does not reach to the point where a notice of sale can substitute for a notice of default, which is also, in our view, statutorily required.
So you would argue that if there's multiple assignments of the deed of trust, beneficial interest of the deed of trust, whoever the last S&E is entitled to 90 days notice, regardless if you were the beneficiary at the time the notice of sale.
Not necessarily, Justice Gibbons. I think you've got to do it once.
Okay.
Here they did it zero times.
Okay.
That's probably.
I just understand the rule you're asking us to adopt, you know, and make sure we get the facts straight.
I think the rule we're asking for here is that the district court considered the notice issue. It correctly determined that the deed in lieu was a false document, and you just have to look at the face of the deed in lieu as well. It's not only is it not signed by the party that...
Let's assume you win on that point. I think that it's zeroing in on this notice issue here. Are you entitled to a separate notice there? Or is there substantial compliance with the notice?
We believe that just omitting one notice entirely, in contradiction to what the trustee recital says, in contradiction to the statute, is just a bridge too far for the doctrine of substantial compliance. That's no compliance. That's okay. Insubstantial, if any. Very briefly, in the 35 seconds I have here, I'd like to note that the buyer cannot be a bona fide purchaser because this is all on record. It's their burden, and it's not correct to say that the district court did not consider it at all. There was a motion for reconsideration and summary judgment, and that issue was placed before the district court, and the district court, in its verbiage for good cause of hearing, rejected bona fide purchasers. So that's properly before the court. And all of this is public record. The last point, we have this question as to whether there even is a lien. I don't think it's the subject of the appeal because the district court did not reach it, but there is the Edelstein factor here. So if the court reverses, it should be not with instruction, but for... Can I finish the sentence?
Yes.
For further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll make a couple of very brief points. While me and Mr. Stern disagree about the substantial compliance as far as the notice of default, I will add this. If the court's inclined to look at that notice of default that didn't go to the beneficiary of the deed of trust is fatal, I would ask that there at least be instructions to provide that allows us to discovery on this case. If you look at the record, we argue that there was a lot of late disclosed documents that at least at this point weren't disclosed until the summary judgment stage. So we feel that there was documents that at least weren't disclosed that we could have done discovery. And very specifically, is that the deposition of Ms. Thompson, who was the Rule 30B6 representative, testified that they do a title report from the NOD, so they would have this knowledge here. Now, the documents were never produced, but the ones that were produced, and this is the record at 143, is that there's a line in Red Rock's financial ledger that says, pay off the NAND, and if you look all the way to the corner to the outside, it says Bank of America. So at least there's an indication that Bank of America Nation Star may have known about the notice of default, but we simply just never got these documents.
Well, so are you agreeing with Mr. Stern then? Do you consider if B of A did not get the notice to which B of A was entitled that somehow Nation Star benefits from that?
No, I disagree with that completely, but I'm saying if the court is inclined to say that substantial compliance means that you still need to do the NOD to the beneficiary that you trust, what I'm arguing is that based on what the record is today, and there's a couple things, is that it's not clear that the NOD wasn't provided to Bank of America or any of the beneficiaries. The documents that were disclosed very late at the motion for summary judgment hearing, which were objected to, that were in our briefing, at least raises the possibility that they should have been stricken, so they shouldn't have been considered. The second instance is that there was never a declaration from B of A by NationStar that said, we never received the NOD, period. The only argument is that you're getting from counsel saying that they never got the NOD, but there's never been any evidence that actually says, no, we never got this.
What we're saying is that based on what's in the record is that we should be allowed, if substantial compliance means that you needed to send the NOD to a beneficiary, that one, that the court allows us to do discovery on this, because again, based on the deposition, based on at least the ledger that says payoff demand BANA, that there's some indication that they knew about this NOD and about the foreclosure that was occurring. So I think the record isn't complete, and I think that when we argued at the motion for summary judgment stage, that we complained about this because, one, these records should have been stricken. All these records should have been stricken, and we should have been able to rely on the deed that says it complied with Nevada law, that all interested parties got notice. So at the time, if one or the other, that we believe substantial compliance that they did know and that the NOS is sufficient, well, then the sale is valid, then instruction should be to remand. If not, if you believe substantial compliance means that you need to send the NOD, well, we're asking that they consider the evidentiary flaws that were in the record that showed that they didn't, because I think that at least it's a question of fact whether they got noted the NOD or not.
Let me ask this in response to Mr. Stern's argument. He's basically saying that you can't have substantial compliance without the initial notice of default because the lender needs this time period to process the claim and make the super priority payment, and just notice of the sale doesn't give them enough time. What's your response to that?
It's their own doing, essentially, because there is all this ample time for them to correct the record. So substantial compliance means that the NOD was sent out to the record holder of the property. And at least that was done correctly. There's no, we're not arguing this point. So I think to that extent that I would disagree, because I don't think that's properly fleshed out in the record here, is that it's either it was done correctly or that we need to go back and look to see if that NOD was actually provided to Bank of America. Because I think that based on how the documents were disclosed, and some of the inferences within the record, the actual record, it's a very good question of fact whether they actually got it or not. Because there's simply no declaration, no evidence that says, no, we didn't get it.
So if they did get it, your position is Mr. Stern's client walked into their position, so they're out of luck.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Any additional questions?
No.
Counsel.
Thank you for time. Thank you.
We're going to thank counsel for the arguments this day. To clarify the record in this particular case, this matter will stand submitted. We are in recess.